From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Yeah, new democracy in Greece. When will people stop being fooled by these new democracy parties? Thank you, Oliver. Welcome to Monday's Richie Allen Show. It's just after 5 p.m. UK time. We are live. It's brilliant to be with you. You can tweet at the programme right now. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. That's my handle. Welcome to your programme.
Richie Allen.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
I've got two terrific journalists and researchers for you today. Coming up in the first hour, Diane Emerson joins the program. A remarkable lady. She created the first online forum for victims of psychopaths over 18 years ago. And she wrote a book called Psychopaths in Our Lives, My Interviews, a very well-received book. She'll be joining me, Diane, to talk about the arrest of the billionaire convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Don't miss that. Diane Emerson joins the programme this hour. And coming up a bit later on in the second hour of the programme, I'll be joined by Michael O'Bernicia. Fascinating man, a stand-up comedian, a playwright is Michael, and he co-produced, edited and directed the outstanding Great British Mortgage Swindle, which was released in the UK late last year. You don't want to miss Michael O'Bernicia. He joins me in the second hour. So it's a busy old programme then today. Good weekend? Yes? Yes? Good Monday? Yes? All good in your world? No? No? Don't complain to me. I'd complain, but who'd listen? As the old saying goes, I'd complain, Richie, but you wouldn't listen. I'd listen. I'll always listen. It is the 8th of July. The media, dominated today by the leak. The leak. The leak. Did somebody take a piss somewhere they shouldn't have? No. It's a leak by, it's not by Sir Kim Darroch, but he's the UK's ambassador in DC. But his emails were leaked. Emails in which he described Donald Trump's administration as pretty woeful. Okay, Theresa May said that she stands by Sir Kim, not in terms of what he said, but she stands by him as a very worthwhile and a very good civil servant. But she disagrees with his assessment of the Trump regime in DC. The Trump regime. So the government has begun an inquiry into the leak of the emails. It's all over the news today. It's a non-story. Maybe there's an issue with the leak in terms of the Official Secrets Act, but this is the sort of story you're going to see more and more and more. Told you about the 24-hour news channel and how it has replaced the daytime soap operas, how they have had to become more entertaining in the way they deliver the programme. Told you about this. My opinion, news channels don't report any news. They don't do investigative journalism. They do not hold power to account. News channels programme you and programme me. They turn up to crises. Real ones and manufactured ones. They breathlessly take you into the middle of the action, as I've covered many times on my programme. And now they do these stories, like from OK Magazine. He said, she said. Trump is fighting with Bette Midler. Bette Midler said this about Trump. Trump is fighting with the UK ambassador to DC. You see what's going on here? It is garbage. But people are sucked into it. Heck is in the news. Heck. What's Heck, Richie? Well, Heck makes gluten-free sausages. And boigers. Boiger. I told you I can't do accents. Heck makes gluten-free sausages and burgers. It also makes vegan food as well. It manufactures vegan food. Well, hundreds of people have taken to Twitter, thousands even, pledging to boycott Heck after Boris Johnson was pictured at its Yorkshire factory last week with a string of sausages around his neck, brandishing packs of Boris Burgers. No, Boris Bangers. That's right, Richie. Boris Bangers. Boris Bangers were made in his honour. So Johnson, of course, was touring the UK as part of his leadership bid. Said he was insanely proud to have a sausage named after him. and he promised to back Heck's plans to build a sausage museum in North Yorkshire. So Heck welcomed the would-be Prime Minister, gave him the treatment, and the snowflakes are in meltdown. Remainers are swearing to never buy the products again. Now, dear listener, you might be forgiven for saying, Richie, that's another non-story. It isn't. It's a big story. We are being transformed into a screaming bunch of narcissists who have begun to hate utterly anyone, anybody, anything that disagrees with us. Screaming, roaring with rage. I used to like Heck sausages. They were lovely. Smell of them frying in the morning on the frying pan, lovely. But they welcomed Boris Johnson to their plant. We can never eat them again. There was a guy on Sky News this morning talking about, not that particular story, but about the mindset. And his name is Tatton Spiller. What a name that is. Tatton Spiller, that's a name. Forget Richie Allen, that's a name, isn't it? That's as good as Max Power. Tatton Spiller. What's your name? Tatton Spiller. That's a good name, that son. It's a good name. Anyway, he used to work at Westminster, did Tatton Spiller. He's got a book out now called Simple Politics about how we can better engage those we don't see eye to eye with. Good idea. How do we better engage those we don't see eye to eye with? Anyway, he was on Sky News this morning and he was with Adam Bolton, Bunter. Here's Tatton Spiller.
We have so many people in increasingly smaller and smaller and smaller echo chambers.
We do.
Only broadcasting what they want and not listening to what other people have to say. So what the book does is says, let's not do this. Let's listen and have a better conversation about politics.
And it's not a bad idea, that, is it? Let's listen to the people with whom we disagree and have a chat with them. And who knows what might come of that, right?
And it's also the breakdown because it explains how other people think. So that when you hear that somebody, let's say somebody wants to privatise the NHS, that's not necessarily because they're an evil person trying to make millions from the privatisation of the NHS. They might just believe that free market competition helps to make things more effective. Well, the disconnect is taking place every day where political conversations try to take place but end up with people calling people fascists and trots and disregarding the other people as I mean, generally, the left think the right are heartless and the right think the left are stupid. Yeah. And we can't
but
get past
that. But that's not
the
politicians who are saying that. I mean, that is a lot of people on the public, particularly in social media.
Yes, and I mean, that's it, isn't it? It's these echo chambers are created by people, and then the people that they vote for, it changes the political landscape.
Yes, it does change the political landscape. It changes the human landscape, because people increasingly don't behave like human beings used to behave. We used to be quite happy to entertain other men and women who have different outlooks on life than we do ourselves, but not anymore. I wonder, do guys like Tatton Spiller understand this is part of a very long-standing agenda to transform human thinking, the human experience, to make us more and more inward-looking, and to push us into smaller and smaller and smaller frames of reference in terms of how we see the world? Because it suits, who does it suit when we behave like that? When we kill one another, when we hate one another, just because of something as trite as an opinion. Who benefits qui bono, eh? Eh? Anne Widdecombe was on Good Morning Britain earlier today. You know I love Anne, love Anne. Richard Bacon was sitting in for Piers Morgan. Bacon is a reformed drug abuser, former Blue Peter presenter, lives in the United States, and I think he nearly died last year or the year before that. He asked Anne Widdecombe, did Richard Bacon, do you regret comparing membership of the European Union to the slave trade?
I have no regrets at all. If you actually listen to what I said there, it's quite clear. I said that throughout history, there's been a pattern of people turning on those who exercise power over them. And I use the feudal barons and the peasants and the colonies and empires and slaves and their owners. And those were three examples. No, I have no regrets.
I live in America at the moment, and if a politician made a comparison like that in America, they'd be more or less finished.
If a politician compared some situation, any situation, to being tantamount to slavery in America, he or she would be finished. Think Richard Bacon is maybe back on the wacky-backy, maybe.
And I don't quite... Let me just understand the metaphor. So, in the European Union, you're there in that parliament, you've democratically been sent there, and the European Union comes up with some directives that are occasionally, sometimes and sometimes not, implemented into British law, and you compare that to slaves being taken from Africa to the Caribbean and overthrowing their slave owners. And I can't understand the metaphor.
Richard just can't understand. He just cannot understand for the life of him what Anne is talking about.
Metaphor.
Anne?
Well, I'm sorry you can't understand it because it's very straightforward. It was.
That's a nice way of saying you're a moron. It's pretty straightforward, Rich, if you paid attention.
It was one of three examples, not just one isolated on its own. About how people will eventually turn. And I, you know, you've quoted the Caribbean. I could have been thinking of the Spartacus revolt.
Well, yes. Which one were you thinking of?
How eventually people turn on those who exercise too much power. And that is what is happening in the EU. They are exercising too much power over sovereign states, which aren't actually particularly sovereign anymore. And we have turned against that. Now, frankly, trying to make a drama out of that is silly.
Oh, it's very silly. What was Bacon's immediate response to this?
I don't think it's silly at all. It takes a lot to shock me, and I was shocked by that comparison.
Wow. He's not much of a man, is he? It takes a lot to shock me, but I was shocked by that comparison. Ding, 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 ding. What's that the sound of? That's the sound of 500 extra points in the virtue signalling Olympics. Well done, Rich. You've told the far left and the left, the snowflakes and the multiculturalists and the progressives, you've told them that you're okay. You're not racist. You were shocked. Don't get shocked by much, but I was shocked by what you said, Anne. Said Richard Bacon. What a plonker. This is the Richie Allen Show, by the way. There is no snowflakery on this programme. My name is Richie Allen. It's exactly 16 minutes past the hour. Woolly, woolly, woolly. 16 minutes past the hour it is. It is Monday, July 8th, 2019. Two brilliant guests coming up on the programme. Michael O'Bernicia joins me in hour two. Coming up really soon, Diane Emerson. You don't want to miss either of those two very interesting researchers, journalists, authors, playwrights, smart folks, smart people we've got on the programme today. Richard Bacon, huh? I missed this yesterday on Sky News, yesterday morning. Don't know how I missed it. Environmental activists want you and me and everybody else to commit to not flying for 1 year to save the planet. One of these lunatics is a woman called Anna Hughes. Scientist? No. Anna is an author and a campaigner. She's an author and a campaigner. We want everybody to commit to not flying for 1 year in order to save the planet. Stephen Dixon was the host. Isn't it a bit much to ask, says Stephen to Anna Hughes?
Yes, it is a big ask, but...
Well, don't fucking ask it then.
In the context of climate emergency and the climate crisis that we're facing, just 1 year off flying is... in the grand scheme of things, not too much of an ask. We're not saying don't travel, and we're not saying that you can't have that summer holiday, so there are plenty...
We are not saying don't have that summer holiday. Wouldn't it be great to be the presenter just once? Anne, who the fuck are you, Anne, to be telling people they shouldn't fly for a year? Who are you, love? I say you're a campaigner and you're an author. Who the hell... Where do you get the balls, Anne, to come on to national television and tell people that they should do this and they should do that, and then say, we're not asking for this, we're just asking for this. Who are you? But of course, Stephen Dixon, very polite presenter, not as rude as me, not as much of an arse as me. So he just lets her carry on.
To your places here in the UK, within train distance in Europe.
have a staycation.
In Europe, you can easily reach the Malaga and the Mediterranean by train or by coach or by other means. So it's not saying you can't have that holiday. It's not saying you must restrict yourself. It's not saying it's a sacrifice.
Well, it better not be, Anne, because nobody, not least a lunatic fishwife like you, is going to tell me that I can't take an aeroplane for a year or that I should commit to doing the same. Okay? Okay.
But it's just looking at things in a different way. So there are loads of other ways you can travel.
I just wonder, I mean, it makes a very good point, actually.
Yeah. And
a lot of people will see it as making a good point. But what difference does it actually make if 100,000 people give up flying for 1 year, but not for two or three or four?
Well, what we're looking at is behaviour change. So partly the campaign is to raise awareness of the climate impact of aviation, which is huge, and also to start to introduce the idea of behaviour change. So if we look at a parallel with meat eating, for example, and veganism, 10 years ago that was a kind of very sidelined movement and one that few people had heard of and that few people understood the reasons for. But now you can look at veganism as something that most people have heard of and understand perhaps why people would choose to be vegan. So we can use that as kind of a parallel for reducing or...
No, you can't. Many people choose veganism because they are understandably, justifiably concerned about animal welfare. All right. Don't be comparing the two. But they want to mix these issues. They want to say that eating meat is not conducive to reducing carbon emissions. This is how they're carrying on, you see.
Or cutting out flying. This is a fly less campaign in general because, you know, 1 year off is not saying you can never fly again. Mm. But again,
is not saying that you can't fly again. But who would you be to even talk about that? And this is the problem, you see. It is 20 minutes past the hour. Mad woman Anna Hughes on Sky News yesterday. Oh, lots to talk about on today's programme. Tweet to me, it's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Look forward to hearing from you. I am going to take a tune, am I? Indeed I am. Let's have a tune. Why not? Yeah, I'm always very well prepared, me. This is music from Mumford & Sons. This is your Richie Allen Show. Welcome to it, Monday, July 8th. Diane Emerson comes up next. Music from Mumford & Sons on the Richie Allen Show. The time is approaching 23 minutes past the hour. Just before we welcome Diane Emerson, the BBC is reporting in the last 15 minutes that the billionaire financier and convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein has been formally charged in New York with running a vast network of underage girls for sex. The indictment alleges he enticed minors to visit his Manhattan and Florida mansions between 2002 and 2005. According to the charges today, the girls, some of them as young as 14, were given hundreds of dollars for sex acts. Epstein is expected to plead not guilty to these charges. Let's welcome our first guest. She created the first online forum for victims of psychopaths over 18 years ago. She's the author of the terrifically reviewed book, Psychopaths in Our Lives, My Interviews. That's Psychopaths in Our Lives, My Interviews. And you can find her on YouTube. If you go to youtube.com, you can find her under the channel Psychopath in Your Life, where she uploads regularly and has a huge audience. Let's welcome to the programme Diane Emerson. Diane, I'm thrilled to make your acquaintance. How are you?
Hey, Richie, I'm doing great. Thanks. How's the sound, okay?
You sound fantastic. It's almost like you're in the room, Diane. It's terrific. Thanks for coming on today. You've been covering this for a long time. Jeffrey Epstein, convicted paedophile, has been indicted in a court in New York this afternoon. Two counts of trafficking girls as young as 14. I'm guessing none of this comes as any surprise to you, Diane.
No, actually, this case has been buried for years now. I'm a little bit suspicious. I think there's been collusion on both sides of the pond over this deal because you got your Prince Andy over there. It's been buried for years now. And unfortunately, what they did in the meantime was beat the victims to pieces. So everybody was afraid to come out. But our FBI under Mueller, who everybody thinks is such a great guy, buried the case with over 40 to 80 qualified victims of rape. It's not sex with kids, it's rape. So it got buried, and it's been buried, and it was never a case like this has been buried before in this way. So finally, it's coming to light. So let these pedophiles all be running and screaming now.
This is an interesting, this is really interesting, Diane, because you mentioned Prince Andrew. And in the interest of balance, I will say, even though I understand where you're going with it, but I will say in the interest of balance, Prince Andrew knew, or he knows this guy, other high-profile politicians and financiers knew or know Jeffrey Epstein. It might be unfair to insinuate wrongdoing or bad behavior by any of these guys just because they knew him. What do you think?
Sure. Well, you know, there's photos of him with a girl who's one of the main accusers, Virginia Roberts, standing next to him and Giselle Maxwell. At this point, with the record sealed, it's anybody's best guess. But there's been a couple of high-profile lawyers trying to keep this thing buried. One of them was representing Maxwell, and the other was a private, high-powered New York City attorney. But looks like it hasn't worked because the thing's coming to light now. So, yeah, I'm not allegating that. And also remember, Andrew, after Epstein's conviction, there's a picture of him walking with Epstein in Central Park. So, you know, what are we supposed to conclude?
What we would conclude fairly, I think, is that neither you nor I would consort with a convicted paedophile. I wouldn't be seen dead.
That's for sure.
Isn't that true, Diane? You wouldn't be seen dead in Central Park with a convicted paedophile. And you've got to wonder about that. What about Bill Clinton? By the way, I'm going to put links out to Diane's channel. I wasn't surprised that after I mentioned Diane was coming on, that some of my listeners had, they'd known about you before I did, Diane. They're onto your channel on YouTube. Go and check her out. I'll put links onto it if you haven't. On Twitter, if you haven't met her before. Let's talk about Bill Clinton, because my listeners are asking me, so this guy has been charged with two counts going back to 2002-2004. Bill Clinton was on the so-called Lolita flights over 26 times, maybe more. I think Clinton should certainly be questioned under caution. Some of my listeners are saying, with the many connections that Epstein had to the very, very, very powerful, politically and financially, what are the odds of something happening to Epstein? You know, maybe we shouldn't speculate about things like this, but will Epstein ever make it to trial?
Well, we hope he will, because they popped the case open, because they've had all this stuff buried for years now. It's been a very ugly battle between Alan Dershowitz, who has been on the side of Epstein, fighting against the victims, treating them horribly. So the evidence is all being buried. So all we can do, and what I did in my show, was pull together all of the known pieces, because I do what's more called forensic journalism. In other words, research all known records and come to conclusions that people maybe have missed in the past. So yeah, so they're all in there. And there's also other things to think about. They know that they were flying around on that Lolita Express. So that's called trafficking, right?
Yeah.
When you take young kids on a plane. Well, the plane was equipped with a bed and lots of sex going on from what is reported. So they only have the records of who they knew was on those flights, okay? And several of the times, Clinton actually flew without a secret service detail. So then you got to look at other things. They used the jet a lot. Clinton and them flew all around the world doing God knows what to people in third world countries, okay? So girls in other countries. So you got to conclude this. We only have the flight records, and the flight records are very sketchy of who was on the plane. So those that we know were on the plane are Clinton and a bunch of them. But remember this, if you're a smart pedophile, okay, and you're going to go to Epstein's Island where they all did orgies and had all kinds of stuff going on there, as reported by the victims, okay, who I have every reason to believe, not everybody flew there on his plane. There's lots of ways to get to that island by boat and stuff. So I don't believe the flight records will tell us everything.
This is it's incredibly powerful stuff, this, because some of us in the independent media have been talking about VIP paedophile rings for many, many years. And you will know, Diane, that the British press and the establishment is working very hard to paint the victims as delusional fantasists. Is that going on in your country, in the United States? Are you seeing that? You know, people being...
Yeah, go on. It happens everywhere. I started researching with the Madeleine McCann case back in episode 73, and things weren't adding up. So from there, I went on an extensive research into all the care homes in the country. I went how they feed pedophiles, these care homes do. I landed on the Isle of Jersey, the second biggest place. It's as big as Switzerland. They had a big scandal there in the care home there. The Crown said they were distancing, but, you know, why'd they seal the records up for 100 years? Yeah. So, yeah, what's happening with these rings is all over. Epstein is just the tip of the iceberg. They just busted a ring in Italy just last week. That was a really big one. It was social workers, psychologists, authorities. They basically take children from the poor and sell them off to the elites for sex. Rape. I don't like to use the word sex because children cannot consent.
How did they get away with this, Diane? The question, there will be skeptics listening to this. There will be. And they'll be like, yeah, there's Richie again now. And he's brought on another guest to talk about this. Very savvy woman, very smart. But how can they do this in broad daylight without anybody blowing the whistle on it or screaming bloody murder? How do they manage to do it, especially in this era of social media? We've never been more connected. Everybody is a journalist. How have they managed to do it, Diane?
Well, they've gotten away with it because a lot of us weren't online talking about this stuff a few years ago, okay? Let me give you an example. I just figured out in your country, in the UK, they passed an Investigative Powers Act of 2016,
yes,
okay?
They did.
That just got revised in 2018. Now, who is in charge of that?
Lord Fulford.
Guess what his background is?
You can remind our listeners. Go ahead.
Yeah, Lord Fulford is appointed by the Queen. He was a QC, which is a Queen consort. He rose his way up through the political ranks. But in the 70s, there was a group operating in the public called PIE, and that stood for Pedophile Information Exchange. The whole idea of the group was to promote that children are born wanting to have sex. So at that time, they were trying to lower the age of consent to 4 years old. Okay. That's that guy. Okay. So there's a whole group of them that were founding members of PI. I have found every one of them in high positions, all of them. Okay. Luckily I have a good memory for names because when I'm researching, they keep popping up. So anyway, so this Fulford guy, he has now ultimate power over all of the investigations there. So you tell me, is that the cat in the hen house or who?
It's incredibly shocking for people who are new to this information, but it is absolutely true.
Well, here's the deal. PI was operating in the public. Everybody knew it. They only stopped operating in the 80s, okay? But every one of the PI founding members and Lord Fulford, I have another name for him, but I'll spare my foul language here. He was a founding member. His role was to go easier on the pedophiles, okay? He became a circuit court judge. I just did a show about him. I think it's either the last show or this one. He's got all the power. He was appointed by the Queen. He got his knighthood, I'm going from memory here, by Blair and them. So everybody knows, okay? And he says, I don't remember any of this. So my conclusion is either the royals and your government hire people with extremely bad memories or they think we've all forgotten.
Yeah, Fulford, this is absolutely incredible information. We know about it, of course, but many people listening to the program won't know about it.
Yeah.
And again, you talked... go ahead, Diane.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you talked earlier on about why would Andrew consort with Epstein, the convicted paedophile? How could Tony Blair's government award a knighthood to a man whom they knew wanted to lower the age of consent to 4 years old? That sort of man should sicken you. You shouldn't want to be anywhere near him, really, let alone give him a knighthood.
Look, look at your royal family, okay? Savile was Prince Charles's best friend, best confidant. He tried to intervene with Princess Diana. Everybody, they gave him the keys to Broadmoor, for God's sake.
Tell me this, Diane. Sorry to interrupt you. Tell me this. When you say Savile tried to intervene with Princess Diana, I know where you're going with this, but some of our listeners don't. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, Savile being best friends of Prince Charles when they were going through their problems, which I believe they were completely gaslighting the poor girl, she figured out who they were, okay? And so she considered, I think she called Savile a reptile. She called the royals reptiles. I can't remember. She was disgusted by Savile.
Yeah.
And so they tried to use him to convince her to hang around. And by that point, she had seen enough and was ready to go. So, yeah, so you also remember people talk.
Well, we've lost Diane momentarily. I hope we get it back, the call. it's coming back now, is it? Is it? Let's see, does it come back? Diane, are you there? Right, we might have to reconnect there. Just as we're talking about Savile and the royal family, the call dropped out. And she didn't hang up. The call just dropped out mysteriously there. How strange. Diane Emerson is on the line. She's an author and a very successful vlogger on YouTube. A journalist, genuine one. The author of Psychopaths in Our Lives, My Interviews. Very well received book on... This is extraordinary. On Amazon. My Skype account is playing up in a way that it's never done before. What's going on here at all? Let's try it again. Wow. How strange. No idea what's going on here. It keeps closing down by itself, the Skype account. And it shouldn't do that. There's no reason to do that. It wouldn't close down unless I was to close it down. So I'm going to ask Diane to call me. This is live radio, folks. There's no producer. There's no editor. There's no control room. So you've got to wing it when it's going wrong. Diane Emerson, we're going to hopefully reconnect with her. Extraordinary stuff. How could Jimmy Savile get as close to the royal family as he did? How would the royal protection detail, how could they have allowed Savile to get as close to the royal family as Savile did? How? Yeah? I might be struggling here to connect with Diane again. Something very strange and unusual going on here. I do mean that, by the way. You know me, I've never said anything like this, ever. Sometimes we have... It's very, very rare we've got a problem. Some of the listeners will either jokingly say that we're being interfered with, and I will always dismiss it, but I wonder... Diane, welcome back. I've no idea what happened there. Just
yeah,
as you were talking...
Yeah, we had a blip out here on the grid. Savile connects to Thatcher. He connects to all of them, okay? All of those people all connect. I've drawn the connections to every single one of those people. And so them all saying nobody knew anything is a bunch of bull, okay?
How could Jimmy Savile get so close to the royal family when he was a record-breaking paedophile? This is a great question. I know you've discussed this yourself. Savile was known by the security detail for the royal family. He was known to MI5. And yet,
sure he was.
Of course he was. And yet he was given unprecedented access to the into the bowels of Buckingham Palace. They knew what he was and they didn't care what he was, which begs the question, what exactly are they if they don't care about Jimmy Savile and what Jimmy Savile was doing? Dreadful stuff.
Well, they all knew. So why do you think they're, May was the one, Theresa May, she got her job by hiding that Westminster pedophile list. So they all know. So why do you think they're tightening up the investigative act so that they have Fulford in charge of everything? What better way to keep a lid on all the pedophile activity? Because it's going to be up to him whether they get reported or not.
It's even worse because Fulford was also promoted in the last few years to the Chief Justice at the Appeals Court.
It's
staggering stuff, this. Diane Emerson created the first online forum for victims of psychopaths and wrote the book. I've just tweeted a link to the book, Psychopaths in Your Life. And Diane can be found on YouTube if you just entered the search term psychopath in your life. In fact, Faisal, a listener, has tweeted that. I've retweeted it. Let's talk about Jeffrey Epstein again, because he might be a very large piece of the puzzle here globally. Listeners have said, and these are non-partisan listeners now, some of them are partisan, they've said, right, Clinton and Hillary Clinton, child traffickers, vile people, but what about Donald J. Trump? What about Trump? Trump's people seem to want to dismiss any prior relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, but it smells a little bit to me, Diane. I think Trump knows Jeffrey Epstein well and has known him very well. What do you think?
Of course he does. He's made comments saying that he's a great guy and they both like young girls. And remember, there's a case out there that hasn't come forward about Trump yet. And also remember, there was a man named Alex Acosta. Okay. He was the guy in charge of prosecutions in the state of Florida when all this happened. Acosta, there was an FBI case that was open with over 40 victims, okay? Solid, solid case. How did he get dropped down to a state charge with two charges, okay? They actually got Epstein on charges of hiring prostitutes. That's what they called these girls, prostitutes, okay? They were raped by these people. So anyway, so this Alex Acosta guy was in charge in Florida when this whole thing broke loose. He was the one that cut the deal. He cut the entire deal, and he cut the deal to bury it legally, okay? So where do you think Alex Acosta is working right now? Jesus. He is now in Donald Trump's White House in charge of trafficking for this country.
Isn't that extraordinary? And Trump's supporters will be listening to this, and they will be screaming at their computers and at their radios, and they will be saying, this woman is mad. Trump is doing everything he can to bring down child trafficking in the U.S., they will say.
Yeah, well, that's how you hide things. We know, in all the research I do, when somebody says something, I always have to think the opposite, because what a better way to cover than to act like you're doing something about something, but you're not doing anything. So you explain to me, why did he hire the guy that buried the Epstein case to be in charge of the White House? That is as solid as a connection as I could ever find, okay?
It's inexplicable, isn't it? And it also begs the question, are people like Donald Trump and, dare we say, Barack Obama, George W. Bush, are they put in the White House because it is easy to compromise these people? Do all of these people have questions to answer in terms of, I mean, I know Obama's backstory is bizarre in general, but you wonder about, you know, we've seen over the years, even in film and in media, in fictional books, they always use sex, underage sex, which is rape, as you quite rightly said, often to trap and ensnare people. You'll be aware of course, Diane, the horrible comments made by Tim Fortescue, who was Edward Heath's chief whip in the 1970s, who admitted to the BBC that if members of Parliament were found to be raping small boys, the people like Tim Fortescue would bury that because they could then basically blackmailed that MP into voting however they wanted him to vote in the future. So I wonder just how, in terms of politicians, presidents, how many of these people do we even guess are compromised through child trafficking and child sex?
I would say this. I did a year looking into relentlessly 14-hour days to understand how these rings operate. And the number one thing they all do is blackmail, okay? And one thing that's missing from the Epstein case is this, and I don't know if it's going to come out in these new records, but Epstein allegedly had his house and his properties wired for sound and videos, okay? Very high-tech thing going on there. So far, none of those tapes have shown up. But in every case that I have researched, blackmail is the name of the game. That's how they control them. That's how they manage them. So, yeah, they all blackmail each other. And then you get a lot. And so any Trump listeners, listen, I don't give a damn about party affiliation, okay? I'm not against anybody. I just want the friggin' truth. So if your guy is in the truth, I'm going to talk about the truth. But yes, they're pretty much all in covering for each other.
We've had
blackmail
is the name of the game. We've had a few tweets. We've had quite a few tweets on it. Charlotte is listening to this program in the northwest of the UK. She's in Burnley and asks, didn't Trump talk about Epstein in the debates? Didn't Trump hint that he needs investigating re the little island? Or maybe that was a way of getting people on Trump's side. I don't remember Trump talking about Epstein, but maybe he did.
Well, I don't remember he did, but, you know, here's the thing. Whatever they're saying is just a cover for themselves, because once they realize that one of them's gotten snagged, they all start to distance themselves. So it's all blackmail, every bit of it. Like on the Isle of Jersey, that was 6x6 my island, okay?
Yeah.
Massive pedophile problem there in the care home system. Two rogue cops came along and blew the cover off it. Otherwise, it'd still be hidden. But then you ask yourself, okay, they did a report. Every one of these care homes that I followed, they do a report. The report makes the public feel good, like somebody's doing something. Nothing has ever come out of a single report. The report they did on the Isle of Jersey, it's richer than Switzerland, okay, where everybody hides their money. Massive pedophile on the island. So what they do? The Crown sealed the records for 100 years.
100 years, yeah.
And that was after two rogue cops, and they put those guys through hell, okay? There was a senator on the island, and he blew the first whistle, because what the cops noticed was that a lot of suicides were happening, which just happens to these poor victims, because they end up either killing themselves, going to drugs or alcohol. So a couple new cops that weren't part of the system that came in from someplace else, okay, they started noticing that a lot of these suicides had been raised in this one particular care home called Hôte de la Garenne. So they did the investigation, and so what they did to them was one of the senators, they locked up a couple of times. What they will do is try to take the truth tellers and accuse them of being pedophiles themselves to hang it around their neck. So yes, they have a process that in every country, every place I've researched, same deal, blackmail. Or they also, a lot of them are Freemasons and Illuminatis, where they're all sealed in secrecy.
Tell me this, Diane. So, when I say tell me this, this is speculation. Why? Why children? Why the rape of children? Why is it so prevalent amongst this class of people? It seems to be far more prevalent. You know, I come from a working class background, Diane. I'm an old socialist. So do you. And you know just how reviled people like us are by this, our parents, our grandparents. I'm not saying that there are not child abusers in working class communities. Of course they are. But it pales by comparison to this class of people, the privileged, the elite, the powerful. Why? What is it? What's going on?
Well, they have a lot of sicknesses. And actually, truthfully, I researched around the world. It's as bad in poor countries as it is in rich countries. I consider it a war on children, and children have become used to be targets and commodities in most of these situations. I mean, I went through every single country. At one point, I got my brain fried a little bit researching it all. So my point now is I'm trying to, after I've absorbed it all, is present it in a way that people will hear what I'm saying, because I don't go graphic because I've already been there. I've seen what it is, but I've got to find out a way to communicate it so people will open their ears up. It's a worldwide problem, and children are the targets. What do you think is happening with kids? I support groups in Yemen. They're being hauled off and raped and killed and murdered. So, yeah, it's a terrible situation, but
we saw this. Sorry, Diane. Sorry to interrupt you. This, because you're segueing into something very important. We saw this with the charity Oxfam, which is a British charity with a global presence, where very senior executives. And again, you've actually got me thinking about something very important. Without even thinking about it, I would read the stories about Oxfam where they say child prostitutes. That's an oxymoron. That's a disgusting way to phrase it. You're very right here. It's very good of you to say that. We should never say child prostitutes. Children don't have any choice. They're not prostitutes. And they're being raped. They're rape victims. It's very important. So we're seeing disasters around the world, often disasters that have been manufactured illegal wars. In come the non-governmental organisation and the charities. And amongst the NGOs and the charities are child abusers everywhere, right?
Child rapists. And here's the thing.
Child rapists.
Here's my saying about that. When they come to pray, P-R-A-Y, they're looking for prey, P-R-E-Y.
Jesus.
And the charity that I'm setting up in Yemen right now is, my number one thing is that we're going to be looking for the good ones. I'm not going to worry about the bad ones because there's too many of them, because it's a worldwide problem and children are just so vulnerable. They have no future if we don't get in hand and protect them. So, yeah. So anyway, so when I was looking around at all these things, I mean, I've done shows about the Catholic Church, you know, their thing, you know, they're really a pedophile ring. Okay. So they're disguised as a church. My view is if you're raping kids, you lose your nonprofit. No questions asked. You know, Pell was the first one, Cardinal Pell, that they really nabbed, okay? But they only nabbed him on a couple of charges. He's been doing that stuff for years. But you know what? He's back in Rome now. He's still a cardinal, pending appeal. And every one of these cases that comes forward, they get it because their statute of limitations doesn't hold up to suspect the victims. A normal victim of rape will not usually know what happened until they're close to 40 or 50 years old, because the mind is powerful. It blocks the stuff out of our minds to help us to survive. So the statute of limitations is all rigged to make sure that nobody is ever going to be able to report, because you don't get raped one day and go report the next day. And then also another issue, which is interesting, they do a lot of weird stuff to these kids, okay? There's a lot of ritual abuse, and I'm not going to go too far into
it. No, but I'm glad you brought it up. I'm glad, because that was my next question, because I've interviewed one or two qualified and reputable psychoanalysts and psychiatrists, and they have told me that some of their patients have relayed stories to them about horrific things that, you're quite right, Diane, we won't get into the graphic details, but ritualistic stuff around Satanism and the devil, horrible things, you know.
Yeah, well, you know why it works?
Go on.
Because when the kids try to report it, it sounds so friggin' crazy that nobody believes them. Hey, look at this as an example for your listeners. We have that creep Joe Biden running for office here, okay? There's a million pictures. Just do a Google search of Joe Biden, creepy Joe Biden pictures and videos, okay? You'll find a million of them. Look at those videos, okay? Those kids are repelling against him trying to maul them, okay?
Yeah.
The adults are standing there laughing. So what happens is that we start to normalize this behavior for the kids. So we don't give them the tools to escape these creeps, because every one of those videos, and believe me, I watch them all of those kids are pulling back and away from that creep. But the adults are all laughing. So what does that do? You cotton ball the kids and you're going to set them up to be future rape victims.
It's horrible, isn't it, Diane?
It's so horrible that and now, you know, if you've seen what's happened on YouTube with the pedo stuff going on, like I say, I'm not going to spit my own cup of tea because it's my only platform, but be careful.
I know you've been talking about that some people have been uploading or sharing images of children, and they're using YouTube to do it.
What they're doing is this. They got caught in February, okay, because the advertisers caught them. So you explained to me how the second largest search engine in the world, this was a mistake. So they got caught in February when the advertisers caught on that their ads were showing up on channels. And the first channel was a family uploading their video, just family videos, you know, just normal stuff, okay? So they got the comment sections got swarmed with pedophiles, and the pedophiles were pointing out at what point the crotch shots happened. Okay. So they were communicating in these things. So what happened? That family video got taken down, but the people doing the vile comments got escaped. So that shut things down for a while. So that was when my channel, I've been doing a podcast. I just moved to YouTube in September because I was hoping to get some advertising money because I can't pay for everything. And so I just barely got there. And in February, they had the clamp down because the advertisers caught the algorithms, okay? So then they did the adpocalypse or whatever the heck they did. So at that point, they hammered about half of my shows. Then there was a New York Times article a couple of weeks ago and about the same issue. The platform is being used, by mistake or not, I don't know, for pedophiles to gain pictures of children. This was according to the New York Times, so this is not just me talking off the cuff, okay? So my biggest thing with my audience right now is do what we used to do. Stop being so damn lazy. Take pictures of your kids, mail them to grandma. If you want them to see some videos, get on, do whatever you have to do, but stop putting them online. So the last time it happened was only 3 weeks ago. What happened to me then? Every channel that I had that had anything, they came up with the new rules, okay? The top rule, most restricted category, includes mainstream media aligns with these people, okay? So the number one most restricted area has to do with talking about the wars and sexual abuse. So that puts me right in the middle, right?
Oh, yeah, you're not getting any advertising. This is it. This is the way they do it. It's horrendous. Yeah.
And I barely have 5,000 subscribers at this point because people, I'm telling people check because they're fanning them off. So, and I get very few views. I mean, look at my views on the series I did about the Catholic Church. I mean, they're just facts. I'm just reporting the facts. I'm not speculating. You've watched my shows. I don't just talk off the top of my head.
No,
I mean,
it's excellent.
These are known facts.
Yeah, it's very good, and I endorse and I recommend our listeners get onto it. I'll put a link out to it.
I get a few hundred views when I'm talking about kids being raped because not only the money, they bury you in search. So, yeah, I'm having a really hard time out there because they don't want to hear what I have to say.
Well, Dan, you're welcome. Yeah. You're welcome to come back on here as often as you want when there are updates to be talked about and to be discussed. I'd be delighted to have you back on. We had a YouTube channel 18 months ago that had nearly 100,000 subscribers, and YouTube deleted the channel. They got rid of it because
sure they did.
Yeah, because I was talking about things like this, and then I launched a new one. And it got to 20,000 subscribers quickly, and then it just stopped to a trickle. And I'm not a researcher like you. You see, I'm not important. You're important because of the work you do. All I do is speak to people like you. But they want to kill these platforms, and they want to destroy people like you. Your growth should be very organic. It should be very quick because you're articulate. You're very interesting. You understand the nuances of broadcasting. It should grow very quickly. But they can't have that. So they will shadow ban you, or as you more eloquently said, they'll bury you in search. People can't find you. And of course, you should show up in people's timelines when people are discussing paedophilia and stuff like that. They should be able to find you, but they're not. And this is where it's going. But there's ways around it.
Look at the list of shows that I've done. Okay, you can look at the whole list in one view. And look at the low views. I started out my podcast so I could help people in the future know if they were dealing with a psychopath. Because I got my life ruined by 1 year ago, okay? So yeah. My whole goal of the podcast originally was to lay down the track. So from now in the future, when I'm gone or whatever, people will be able to have that as a resource. Once I stepped into looking into the connection between psychopaths and pedophiles is when I tripped the wires. You know, do you realize that according to the medical literature that we have, you know how they describe pedophiles? And remember, I have had a couple of conversations with psychiatrists at length, okay, not just casual ones. Nobody has made the connection between psychopaths and pedophiles but me. And it's pretty crazy because when I went through all the medical research, which they all use to come up with their labels of crap, they have this drunk, lonely stepdad theory when it comes to kid rape.
Yeah, they do, don't they?
And you know what? I dropped out of college, okay? I'm not a genius, but I can follow the trail, and I'm pretty damn good at researching. And yeah, the system, it actually started with Kinsey in the 50s. You do realize in the 50s, he was financed by the Rockefellers, okay? And to do research on how sex in America should evolve. And this was in the 50s, okay? He used known pedophiles for his research. Men were at war during this time, okay? He used known pedophiles. He used an SS officer for his research. There is a page in his in this book that came out, and in full view, okay? His first book was about male sexuality. This guy was so sick, he would hang himself by his balls in the basement of the University of Indiana.
Wow.
And the records are still there. They're still hiding the records. So here's this Kinsey guy, very sick, okay? Look up page 34, okay? Right there in the middle of this book that everybody saw in the 50s, everybody, okay? Everybody saw they were doing research on children as young as a few months old using stopwatches to get them to orgasm. So, yeah, and it's been right there in the public. So Kinsey himself then became this hero for whatever reason I'll never know, because I always try to look for who benefits and how this crap start, okay? It started with that, and so he then became a worldwide figure. He went around to countries. He went around. He was the one that helped establish every law we have right now that protects the pedophiles versus the victims. That all happened thanks to the Rockefellers and Kinsey.
Do me a favor, Dan. Come back, right? By the way, Neil Sanders, who's written several books, and he can be found at neilsandersmindcontrol.com. Great guy. Neil is listening and endorses what you were saying about Epstein and Alex Acosta, who got Epstein the plea deal, and how he's in Trump's administration now, and Dershowitz and everything else. Really, really important stuff. Diane can be found on YouTube. I've already tweeted a link out. I will do it again to where you can find her. The YouTube channel is called Psychopath in Your Life, and her book, which was incredibly well reviewed, Psychopaths in Our Lives, My Interviews, can be found. I'm going to say it. I don't like saying, but it's on Amazon if you want to find it there. Find it there. Let's speak again in the early autumn or the early fall, Diane, because there's a lot more we could have talked about, and I do want to chat with you about your research into the psychopathic mind. I'd really love to have you on to talk,
Richie,
about that.
I'm available anytime. I've been out in the wilderness on my own for almost 20 years now. So,
yeah.
It's nice to
meet like-minded people. It's great to have come across you. And I don't know how we ended up connected on Twitter. I have no idea. But I was looking for somebody to talk about this today. And there must be something in the stars, Diane, because all of a sudden I see Diane, right? And we're following each other. I don't know how we are, but we are. And I think, right, and I looked into your background, watched some of the videos, spent most of the day watching the videos, and I thought, this is a smart cookie, this lady.
I think I found you and followed you, but anyway, I was up late last night blasting out everything I could remember in my brain about Acosta, Trump, and all of them. So I think I blasted out about 12 or 14 connected tweets about them all. Whenever you want to talk, I'm here, because this is a big, big problem, and no kid is going to be safe until we get in front of this stuff.
Absolutely. And don't wait to be contacted. I say that to some of my guests, especially ones that are new to me and new to some of my listeners. Don't wait to be contacted. There isn't a producer here. This program is a daily life program, and you know, we do okay, but it's just me. So if you haven't heard from me in a few weeks, drop me a line and say, what the hell is going on, Alan? And I'll be back onto you straight away, Diane. But thanks for doing that today, and thanks for the work you're doing on it. Selfless, tireless work, and it's thankless as well. But your heart's in the right place, and I think we're all the better for having you in the world, I think. Thanks, Diane.
You know what? It's the crappiest work you could research in the world, but I'm not giving up.
No, don't either. Thanks for coming on today.
Thanks, Richie.
Thanks, Diane. The lovely Diane Emerson. Find her, please, on YouTube. Go and find her on Twitter as well. The YouTube channel is Psychopath in Your Life. Google that and you'll find her. And her book, which was really well reviewed, by the way, Psychopaths in Our Lives, My Interviews. And that was motivated by Diane's own experiences, as she hinted at a few minutes ago, going back to a relationship that she had many, many years ago with a psychopath. Neil Sanders has been listening for the last few minutes. Neil will be on the programme on Wednesday. We'll be talking about a film that he's involved in. Very important stuff as well. Time is exactly 5 minutes past the hour. I've got to take a very quick song and get my next guest on. Should have had him on by now, but it's important stuff. It's all important, right? This is the Richie Allen Show, live on Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, triggerwarning.tv, my website, TuneIn Radio, and many platforms around the world. This is Kenny Loggins, back with Michael O'Bernicia in about 3 minutes' time. Yeah, I see the Trump supporters are out in force already. Diane Emerson is non-partisan, or bipartisan. I think you might say bipartisan. Not interested in the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. Non-partisan, bipartisan, not interested. Talked about the Clintons. It's not whataboutery here. Donald Trump has questions to answer about his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. There's no doubt about that. And Alex Acosta and the plea deal and how Acosta ended up in Trump's government. These are important questions. Anyway, let's welcome to the programme my next guest. I'm really excited about speaking to him. Should have happened some weeks ago, but it didn't. But I'm glad he's on the programme now. He is a comedian and playwright. He's an accomplished man, so he is. And he co-produced, edited and directed his second film, The Great British Mortgage Swindle, which I can't recommend highly enough. And you know my word is gold. Now, the film came out late last year and it's terrific. It was set in multiple cities around the country and it showed how devastating mortgage fraud is on ordinary folks, on working class people like us. Institutionalised mortgage fraud. A wake-up call, this particular documentary, it really is. Took the best part of 10 years to make as well. And I came across it initially because I saw Michael and his co-producer appear on RT and I thought, right, these guys are bang on the money here and we better find out more about them. So let's welcome to the programme, thrilled to have him on finally, Michael O'Bernicia joins us live. Michael, welcome to the programme. How are you?
Good evening, Richie. Not too bad considering the week I've had, thanks.
You've had a mad week, right? You can share that with us, by the way. I'm happy to hear about it.
Well, unfortunately, it's exhausting for me to talk about because it's been pretty relentless for the last week. I've just had numerous technical problems involving my PC because I've been encoding a new digital cinema projection for the screening of The Great British Mortgage Swindle, which is set to take place at the Odeon in Bournemouth on Wednesday night.
Lovely.
And myself and Michael O'Dara are going to be hosting TGBMS Next Steps Live straight after the screening. And we've also had word that Thames Valley Police Commissioner Anthony Stansfeld is going to be in attendance. So it promises to be quite an auspicious occasion. And wouldn't you just know it, in such circumstances, everything that went wrong, kind of Murphy's Law, applied. And I've only just managed to get everything done in time for this interview.
Well, it sounds like you're a good man to have in the trenches, Michael, because what I do is I go full-scale diva and start screaming and phoning people. You know what to do. You see, I love guys like you. You can do stuff for yourself and you know the technicalities. Meant everything I said about the film, Michael. It's fantastic. I first got into finance and the creation of money some years ago, reading the great Jim Maher's Trillion Dollar Conspiracy, reading David Icke, not just those guys, but other guys. And your film is terrific. And it's a film that everybody in the country should see. And we're going to talk about the impact the film has had, that it will have. We'll talk about your own story, but we'll also talk about what you are doing about it, because this is really important. Workable solutions. And some of our listeners are going to be surprised by how successful Michael has been and hopefully will continue to be in taking on the fraud that we're going to talk about. So, my friend, and you are my friend, you will be my friend, what did you think when, after everything I'd said to Michael O'Dara and after everything I've ever said, and I know you're new to me and you're new to my programme, but after everything I've said historically about mortgages and fraud and banks, there the future Mrs. Allen and I went to our bank and we borrowed money to get a house. You must have thought, what an insufferable hypocrite that lad is.
No, I didn't. And I'll tell you why, because you represent the vast majority of the people listening and the vast majority of the people who aren't on these shows. Basically, we are placed in a position where if we're not lucky enough, fortunate enough in our lives to be given the sufficient monies to acquire our first property, we have to work and slave for years on end. And if we're lucky enough to be offered what is known as a legal mortgage, the vast majority of people not only jump at the chance of taking it before the bank changes their mind or before their credit rating drops through the floor, and they see that as their opportunity to get on the property ladder. And as a result, most people don't even look at the terms and conditions. That's if they're presented with any, and most people aren't until after they've signed the mortgage deed. But we'll come back to all of that in a minute. So in a brief answer to your question, no, I didn't think you were a hypocrite at all. I empathize greatly with you for and on behalf of everybody else, because this literally is the situation. Most people will never own their own home, and even if they do get a mortgage and acquire a property, they'll be in hock to the bank for at least 25 years if they're fortunate enough to be able to keep up the payments. And there is currently no other viable option.
There's none. The thing was, we were paying £1,000 a month in rent. We don't have a lot of money. We don't. Caroline does okay. She's got a good job. But we don't have any money. And it became impossible. So we found a, you know, semi-detached fixer-upper, basically. And it was half the price of properties in South Manchester, in Salford. And we went, well, let's go for it and do it. And it killed me to do it. It killed me to contact the bank. It killed me to deal with them. It killed me to deal with the broker and all the rest of it, because I know what it is. It's horrendous. But failing that, we couldn't continue in the private rental situation. We couldn't do that. And it was with a heavy heart that I said to the bank, all right then, we will agree to these terms, these ridiculous terms, and we will take this on, because while in the short term we can nearly halve what we were paying in rent, right, we're still ultimately trapped in this fraudulent arrangement whereby we'll be paying, I don't know, 20, 30, whatever it is, percent of what the property is worth. So it's a disaster. But there was no other way out for us. None. And that's it. And, you know, I've had the abusive emails from people. Oh, Richie, I can't believe it. And I'm like, well, you know, find me a place where I can rent and afford to rent and live and do what I'm doing and put food in my mouth and support my family. Show me and I'll go there. Outside of that, I didn't have a choice. Dreadful. But anyway, Michael, there you go.
Well, the first piece of good news that I have to deliver is that despite the fact that with a heavy heart you did go through the process of entering into the mortgage transaction, I can tell you that in line with the recent Supreme Court judgment called TACAR, which reaffirmed as a matter of public policy in this country the long-established principle that fraud unravels all, and that includes judgments, contracts, deeds, etc. So that means, as a consequence of you having no other option in order to advance your family, you can't be held liable for that. And that's another long-established principle of equity. When someone is forced into a position to better themselves and there's no other option, they can't be held liable for any losses that are incurred. Now, that to one side, it's almost immaterial. Because, as I said, fraud unravels all. Now, what that basically means is that the very fact that when you were, and correct me if I'm wrong, Richie, when they presented you with a mortgage deed, did you already own the property that you were buying?
No.
No. Now, were you advised by a conveyancing solicitor to sign the deed without dating it?
Yes, in fact I was. And I knew this because of, again, the documentary and again looking into it and speaking with Michael O'Dara. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Well, that means that as per the binding Supreme Court judgment, Scott v. Southern Pacific Mortgages from 2014, that means because that case established the rule that nobody has the legal or equitable right to grant any interest over any property before ownership. In simple terms, that means you can't sign a deed to a property that you don't yet own. It makes perfect common sense. Well, it's also the law. So basically, that means that you were given illegal advice by your conveyancing solicitor, A, to sign the deed before ownership, and B, to leave the date blank, because that meant, again, it's common sense, that meant that the deed was incomplete at the moment of signature.
Yeah, yeah.
Now you hear conveyancing solicitors bleating on about how no, this is a common practice, that it's well established, it's not a material alteration of the mortgage deed to add the date at a different time in the future, which isn't the day when the mortgagor signed it. Well, there are two big problems with that. The first is that that's not what the land registry say. The land registry have confirmed in writing and on the phone several times that their assumption is that the date that the deed bears when it comes into the land registry for registration is the date that the mortgagor signed. So there's the first massive legal problem. The second legal problem is that since an undated deed cannot be registered legally at the land registry, that means that it was a material alteration for the conveyancing solicitor to add the date, since if he hadn't, it couldn't have been registered as a purported legal mortgage.
So why do they explain, as well as you have done everywhere I've watched you, and this is why it's great having you on today, explain why it matters. Explain in language that our listeners can understand. Explain why the conveyancing people don't just sign it at the correct time, or get you to do it and date it at the correct time. Why do they get so many people to sign it undated? Why?
That is an extremely relevant and pertinent question. So thanks for asking it. It's not an easy question to answer if one isn't pretty au fait with the law of mortgages, but I'll try and simplify it the best way I can. Now, what most people don't know, but has been proven empirically by Professor Richard Werner, is that UK banks and the other banks around the world are not actually engaged in the business of lending money. They're engaged in the business of taking deposit of loan agreements or mortgages, which are also called promissory notes. And they deposit these instruments, these negotiable instruments, into a private deposit account, usually held with a clearance house like Euroclear. So it's completely separate from the bank's accounting. So they deposit that in their own account and take the credit, which is the value of what they claim that they are about to lend you, when what they're really doing is they're taking the credit that you created simply by signing the acceptance of the mortgage offer. That's enough on its own to qualify as a promissory note. So that, in effect, is the money. So when they took that from you, they actually took payment in full. There was no interest applicable because that qualified in law as payment in full. And all the banks know this, and the courts, and they've been pretending otherwise, but we'll come back to that part of it in a bit. Let's just put it in a nutshell. So you go into a bank, you sign an acceptance of the mortgage offer, the bank takes that piece of paper, deposits it, takes the credit from it, and at that point, you should have owned your property free and clear. But while this is happening, they get you to sign a mortgage deed before you owe the property concerned, because they're going to sell that mortgage deed to make the money all over again on the securities market. So what they do is they get you to sign that deed illegally, then they get it registered upon the date of completion. And upon the date of completion, the bank gets in contact with the conveyancing solicitor and confirms that the monies are being transferred to the account of the purported borrower. The conveyancing solicitor gets in contact with the borrower, and the borrower thinks, well, happy days, that's it, the transaction's gone through, nothing can go wrong, when what's actually happened is that there's been a bait and switch. You should, Richie, and your wife should have owned your property outright, free and clear, from the deposit of a promissory note, but instead the credit, the monies have been stolen from you by the bank, and they're now charging compound interest, which is unconscionable at any time in any event, and they're charging that, going to attempt to charge that for 25 years. But their most preferable situation is that you and everybody else can't afford the interest payments, ends up in default, and then they'll take the property, steal it from you, and start the entire swindle all over again.
So it's a 3-time win for the bank then?
Yes.
Probably a 4-time win because they've taken out an insurance policy against the mortgage going into default anyway.
Yes, the insurance makes it 4.
Jesus Christ. And I know this, and I still say Jesus Christ. And I know this to be true. I've spoken about this for years with people, and for years I didn't understand it. And I made myself then go through it, fine tooth, as you've just explained there. And that's the way it is. It's as simple as that. And of course, this is very personal to you and to Michael O'Dara. Tell us about yourself. I know you're sick of it, Michael, but you can be as brief as you want, because obviously it was personal circumstances that set you on this particular road.
Well, some people who are listening may already know, most probably don't. When I was 18, on the last day of my A-levels, I found myself in circumstances where, because of my mother being on the verge of a nervous breakdown because of my dad's bankruptcy and the threat of losing our house, he took my younger sister and her away from the brunt of it. And I oversaw the entire eviction myself with the assistance of my granddad during parts of the day, and in the afternoon I had to go and sit my final A-level in history. And as I was sitting there, having experienced what it's like to see the general callousness of the court bailiffs as they're basically kicking you out onto the street and leaving you for dead, I wrote a message to the person who would be examining my paper, and I told him about the day that I'd had, and asked him that could he judge the questions on the two that I could do, because I hadn't had any chance to revise, and the other two I hadn't been able to start. And I'm happy to say they did feel my pain, and I did pass the exam, and nothing was lost. But when I went back at the end of the day, the official receiver in my dad's bankruptcy, who had brought proceedings to take the house, despite the fact that it was legally owned by my granddad and had been since before the bankruptcy, and he'd still managed to get the High Court to issue an order for him to steal it. And he drives up in his E-Type Jag as I'm standing on the lawn at the end of the day waiting for my granddad to come and pick me up. And he pulls up, winds his electric window down, and looks at me with a look of utter contempt, but also extreme enjoyment. So he was really enjoying the moment. And he said, "Tell your dad that if everything's not out of the house by 7:30, then we're just going to bin it or sell it."
Jesus Christ.
So I looked at him, 18 years old, stand there in a school uniform, just had my last day of school. And without blinking, I said to him, "You've got 10 seconds to drive away. Otherwise, I won't be responsible for my actions." And he went, and everything from that moment, when I came face to face with the sheer malice and contempt of somebody who was representing the Crown's interests, knowing the injustice of what was happening, I just vowed to myself in that moment, I didn't know how, I didn't care how long, I would find out exactly why all of this was totally wrong, I'd prove it was wrong, and I'd do anything that I could to bring the entire rigged system down.
Wow, Michael. Michael O'Bernicia is our guest. I mean, how did you cope with that aged 18? The difficulties of that. Go to the Great British Mortgage Swindle.net online. The Great British Mortgage Swindle.net. Watch the documentary. Buy the documentary. Buy it. Show it to your friends and to your neighbours and get them to watch it. That's powerful stuff, mate, and it's not the first time I've heard that. I want to be the devil's advocate just for a minute. What about people who listen to this? And they say, look, doesn't matter how fraudulent it is. You, Richie Allen, Michael, maybe not when Michael was a young boy, when he was a teenager, but Michael now is an adult, you know that you don't have any money. You know that the bank has money. However the bank gets the money, however it doesn't get the money, however it does get the money, is immaterial. You know that you don't have any money and you want to buy a house. You go to the bank and the bank says, we'll give you £120,000. 120 we'll give you, and we'll charge you 3% interest for 5 years fixed. We'll look at it again in 5 years. You sign on the dotted line, Richie, and then things go bad for you. You've got no right then to come back crying and saying, oh, the bank should have done this. They didn't sign the right papers. They falsified the dates and all the rest of it. The fact is, you knew what you were doing. You borrowed the money. You made, Richie, they'll say, some of my listeners, you made a commitment. A commitment. You signed your name agreeing to pay back the terms that they offered you. So, like it or lump it, is what some of our listeners will say, Michael.
So the way I would respond, with all due respect, is that the bank didn't lend any money. They pretended to in a bait and switch. So it's fraud, and fraud unravels all. So anything that you agreed to is meaningless.
The money never
existed. It's also
unenforceable. And of course, this is what I say to people, the same thing. I say, look, they con people into believing they have loaned the money when they haven't. They created the money out of thin air at the point of issuing the mortgage. But Michael, as smart as you are and as presentable as you are, do you struggle to get people to even begin to try to comprehend that? This notion that, you know, we're not backed by the gold standard. This notion that they do create money out of thin air. This notion that they do not take any risk whatsoever. I mean, how do you do that? How do you explain to people in a way that they even want to hear it?
You learn to not expect, because, you know, that's not good either, but you learn to welcome the usual cognitive dissonance. And I've even had this from judges. I had a QC. I went before QC, and the QC, when we were in the very early stages of the claim against Bank of Scotland, and there was only the QC, who was the judge, his clerk, and me and my dad in the courtroom. And he basically made several observations about what he described as the intelligence of the way the claim had been put together, the erudition. And he also said that if we had the evidence to back up the allegations, which we did, and it should have been in front of him, but someone, of course, had removed it. It was very early on, and things like that did happen quite easily then. And he basically said that I was absolutely bang on about the point that I made in my skeleton argument regarding a promissory note in the form of a loan agreement being just as good as cash in the hands of a bank. So once I got that opinion from him, and then I found out that even the Court of Appeal couldn't throw that particular part of our argument out later down the line, because it's a principle that is well established, and there's a particular judgment that was given by Lord Denning in the late 60s, in which he stated very clearly that the Court of Appeal many times has stated that a promissory note, when given in payment, is just as good as cash, and it should be treated as such. And that case is, I believe it's Fielding versus Platt.
Why was that judgment made, Michael? Why was that judgment made at the time by a wise and savvy old judge who knew what was going on in the world of finance when we came off the gold standard? Because there must have been men and women at the time, learned folks, who knew what was going on. Go ahead.
Again, that's a great question,
isn't it?
I looked into this. I looked into who the characters in banking were,
yeah,
and whether or not there was any over the last century in this country and elsewhere. And I looked to see if there were any obvious connections between the commercial banks and the more powerful private banks that are all owned or at least controlled by the House of Rothschild. Now, what I found was that I'm sure you remember, there used to be a different type of bank in this country that was willing, where the staff and the manager and the assistant manager were all willing to be friendly and helpful to local customers. They would take a risk on you that a computer never would now. And they would do it because they trusted you, that you'd be good for your word. And the vast majority of people were, and those that weren't obviously lost out. But those type of bank managers and banking establishments were completely wiped out by way of the Financial Services and Markets Act in 2000. Now, they started phasing them out a long time before that. But what used to happen, quite simply, is the bank, let's say they were going to allow you to deposit your own promissory note. They would allow you to do it. They would take deposit of it. They would register the deposit with the Bank of England as a valid deposit. They would give you the credit. And then when the credit was extinguished, they would withdraw the note. Now, that was happening in very few cases in each individual branch, but it was happening nonetheless. It normally happened with company accounts. They would allow a company to create such an instrument and draw on it as a line of credit. Now, Denning made that verdict because it was so well established that a promissory note is as good as cash. And you're absolutely right, when a promissory note did not guarantee payment in gold, and that ended, as you know, in this country in 1931, when that ended, the promissory note system was the only system of currency that we had in circulation. And this is, of course, as I already stated, it's been empirically proven by Professor Werner that as I said, banks are not in the business of lending in this country. They're in the business of pretending that they're lending.
This is brilliant stuff, Michael, because at that stage, the banks saw, when we came off the gold standard and banks were allowed to lend up to 6 or 7 times their capital reserves, they saw their eyes opened up with absolute delight, and they saw the opportunity to steal, to rob the world of real assets, of land and of property. That's how I see it. And you're on here to tell it as it is, not me. So correct me if I'm wrong, but that was the point where they thought, marvellous, we can rob now with immunity, basically.
Yes, that is exactly what happened. But it started, the whole process started in this country in 1913, 30. When a series of acts were brought into being, and the more aggressive ones were brought into being when the great slaughter was underway from 14 to 18. Now, if I tell you that the first act of the Federal Reserve upon its creation in 1913 in the US was to grant enough credit to Britain when Britain had never been a debtor nation, had only ever used its own creditworthiness, never as a debtor, and they granted Britain credit that it accepted, which was enough money to basically stand millions of men opposite each other, murdering each other for four years. And they did this deliberately to get Britain into hock so they could justify the call to come off the gold standard, which they did initially prior to 31. And then wouldn't you just know it, Winston Churchill, when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer, was responsible for bringing the country back on the gold standard in 1925, despite the fact that it didn't have either the reserves or the creditworthiness anymore to go back on the gold standard. Again, it was deliberately done to help bring about the Great Depression. And economists like Maynard Keynes was writing about it at the time, talking about the folly of doing so. During the same decade in the 1920s, they also started getting rid of certain provisions within the law that the people had always relied upon. And this resulted in another 1933 act called the Administration of Justice Miscellaneous Provisions Act 1933, which purported to get rid of the grand jury. And government and parliament never ever will have the jurisdiction or authority to get rid of the grand jury, because its authority is of the people, and that's above the state. It's quite clear. So they've been pretending since 33 that the grand jury system could not be applied again on these shores. But again, that's just another fallacy. In truth, what's occurred since then is that this nation has become subservient to the bankers in a way that simply wasn't possible prior to 1933. And I know people think about, oh, well, you know, they were hard times. I'm not saying that there weren't hard times prior to 1933. What I'm saying is that prior to 1933, the mortgage industry was curtailed by the common law in this country and everywhere else, or certainly other common law nations. And I'll tell you how it happened. There was a common law jury which had to preside over every mortgage possession claim by a bank. And you know how many times in the history of the common law mortgage jury that the jury voted to throw a family out on the street?
I'm guessing it's not many, Michael.
None.
None. Not a single time. A common law jury.
So just after, or I think it was just after the Second World War, which was also completely manufactured for other reasons, but too complex to go into now. And again, by the same people who orchestrated the first one, House of Rothschild. But nevertheless, when they created another statute that got rid of the common law county court jury for mortgage possession claims, and the last 50 years or more, the last 60 years of rampant institutionalized fraud was able to begin. And right up until 1989, when an act called the Law of Property Miscellaneous Provisions Act 1989 was brought into being, until that point, it was said by many High Court and Court of Appeal judges that the mortgage industry was like the Wild West. And it got to a point where everybody just agreed that whatever it was that the bank was claiming, they were obviously going to succeed. There was no way around the mortgage deed, no way around the implied contract which arose. And because of this, it was abused to an inordinate degree. And this resulted in the 1989 Act making it law that every mortgage deed had to be properly executed and properly witnessed by an independent witness. That virtually never happens. Every mortgage deed must be preceded by a two-party contract, which must contain all the terms and conditions and be signed by both the bank and the mortgagor. That virtually never happens. In fact, I've never seen an example of it occurring. And we don't know the exact date, but certainly at least since 1989. All the conveyancing solicitors have been advising people to sign those mortgage deeds before they own the property concerned and to leave them undated so they can play that sleight of hand at the land registry and pretend that the mortgagor executed the deed on the date they completed the purchase of the property, which they didn't have the money to buy.
Because the establishment, the elite, whatever we want to call them, we use terms like the hidden hand, they do not want people to be in their own properties that they own and self-sufficient and self-reliant, right? That's part of this. Because of other things and other agendas maybe that are coming down the line. And I know you're very well read and briefed on any number of health issues as well, Michael, and things that are happening to us as people, negative things that are happening that we're talking about at the moment. A populace that is self-sufficient, not stressed by debt, well, it's a dangerous population, isn't it? Because if you're not stressed by debt, if you're not worried about the roof over your head, and if you're not worried about food, well, then you represent a clear and present danger to the establishment, right?
That's right, yes. And what, because you brought the subject up very neatly, what I want to float by people is what I floated in the Renegade Inc. interview on RT, as you mentioned. People naturally assume, because we've been programmed to believe it, that if, let's just say, all the banks went down the pan in the UK because they're all up to their necks in institutionalized frauds and bankers started getting sent to prison and all of the 11.2 illegal mortgages currently registered at the land registry got cancelled, meaning that the chief land registrar was bound to pay compensation, or rather the Treasury through the chief land registrar was bound to pay compensation for all the losses incurred by every single illegal mortgagor who has their mortgage cancelled, and that means everything that you paid to them back plus interest under their rules. Now, if that all happened, people say, oh, but the whole system would implode. The government would go bankrupt because they couldn't afford it. No, as Professor Werner has proven, the Treasury could simply write their own Treasury bill and create the funds to cater to what I estimate to be at least £1 trillion in compensation that's due to the people who currently have purportedly illegal mortgages registered at the land registry. Now, when people say, but you'll just not avert a panic, it'll be impossible. No, it won't. We simply wheel all the criminals into court. We suspend all the bank's operations and we relay the ground rules. And those ground rules should be very simple and straightforward. In essence, if the banks were simply the administrators of our accounts, and instead of stealing the credit created by our signatures on every type of loan agreement, the entire lending industry would not only become obsolete overnight, instead of the banks stealing our credit at compound interest for 25 years, that credit could simply be deposited in the account of the account holder. In other words, we would own our properties without a mortgage through our own deposits of the funds. We wouldn't be ripped off. And perhaps the vast majority of families who feel obliged currently to have two parents working and struggle to spend time with their kids, and they struggle to make ends meet. Well, imagine all those families no longer have a fraudulent mortgage and potential eviction hanging over their heads. And they can sleep soundly in their beds knowing that they're going to have something to leave to their kids. And that maybe, just maybe, they can now afford, because they haven't got a mortgage to pay, for one of them to give up work so they can spend more time with their children.
Yeah, imagine.
If that doesn't sound like a better world than everybody has got at this moment, I don't know what is.
I want to endorse what Michael said there. The economist Steve Keen has been on this program a few times. And I gently got him around to speaking about something he didn't really want to speak about. And it was the creation of money. And Keen reluctantly acknowledged to me, he's a nice fellow, Steve Keen, but he reluctantly acknowledged to me that it is folly for the government to borrow from the Bank of England. And his way of explaining that was, yeah, it is a bit silly for, he used my name, it is a bit silly for Richie to borrow from the Bank of Richie at interest. And I said, well, there you go. What's that all about? And he didn't want to get into it too much. But he acknowledged it. You know, this television economist who's used on Channel 4 News often and elsewhere. And you wonder, why won't they go any further than that, you know? I mean, you've got the basic premise, the basic principle, that it is lunacy for the government to say, OK, we need to build 1 million houses that people can afford to live in. Let's go and borrow. From who? From yourselves? It's crazy, Michael, isn't it?
Yes.
Go ahead, Michael.
But the reason why, it's because the same people behind the institutionalized fraudulent industries in finance, exactly the same parties are behind every single puppet government. It doesn't matter whether you vote Labour, Conservative, Brexit Party. It's all a shambles. It's all a three-ring circus to make you think that those are the people who you're going to grant power to, or other people will grant power to, when absolutely in every case their strings are being pulled by the people that Dennis Healey, before he died, described as those who control the purse strings. And again, it comes back to that same group every single time. And if you look at it this way, Christine Lagarde, the IMF chief, is going to be appointed the new head of the European Central Bank. She's number one on the list. She's the only one wanted by the EU, and she is a convicted fraudster.
Convicted fraudster, absolutely.
Convicted fraudster.
Recent.
Well,
we're only talking a few years ago. Yeah, and you can Google that. Convicted fraudster is going to be given the keys to the European Central Bank. This is a bank that was set up to loan countries up to their tits, excuse the language, in debt, so that those countries could then be forced to accept austerity programs, which meant they would have to give up their assets. So water, any minerals, anything at all of any value in the countries would be pilfered and robbed. We've seen it in the Republic of Ireland. In Ireland, I should say. We've seen it in Greece, Spain, Italy, time and time again. Michael O'Bernicia is our guest. It's, 14 and a half minutes to the top of the year. We've got Michael for about 10 more minutes. I'm telling you, folks, if you haven't seen the Great British Mortgage Swindle, go to thegreatbritishmortgageswindle.net and buy the film. Support fantastic. fantastic independent filmmaking and journalism like this, because it's vital. It really is. You know, I don't say stuff like this unless I mean it. Michael, we've got really positive news, and there's really positive things going on, because not only yourself, your good self, and Michael O'Dara and others, but many people are preparing themselves to take this system on. People that are under the gun at the moment, you know, that are struggling in a fraudulent mortgage, are going to be taking this on in the very near future. Talk to us about that.
Okay. On the 21st of this month, on the outskirts of Nottingham, Michael and I will be convening the Bankster Busters Conference, where we will appoint and train admins, organisers and advocates for each of 17 representative actions that we're bringing in the High Courts all over the UK. And we're bringing these actions for and on behalf of every single illegal mortgagor in this country, all 11.2 million. And we're doing it on what have been dubbed the TGBMS grounds. In summary, the TGBMS grounds are that A, you didn't sign the mortgage deed in the presence of a witness, or it was witnessed by somebody who wasn't independent, or you were asked to leave the date blank. And the second ground, B, is that you don't have a mortgage contract signed by both the bank and the mortgagor and containing all of the terms and conditions in a single document. And the third ground, C, is that as per the Southern Pacific Mortgages judgment, that's Scott v. Southern Pacific Mortgages, in the event that you signed a mortgage deed to a property prior to your ownership of that property, as per that judgment, it was illegal and the transaction is void. Now, if any of the above, or just one of the above, applies to you, and thus far we've never seen one UK mortgage that at least one of those grounds didn't apply to, then you are being, even though it's no liability to you, even if these actions don't succeed, you, as in the people who are not parties to these claims, will have the benefit of being invited, should they succeed, and they're going to, this summer. You will have the opportunity to put in an application to the Land Registry to claim compensation and to get your mortgage, your void mortgage, cancelled at the Land Registry on one or more of those grounds. And we're doing it in representative actions for the purposes of getting a declaration from the Royal Courts of Justice that there will be test cases for each of the arguments that we're putting forward that will all be consolidated into one, and that one test case inevitably must be put before the Supreme Court because it's a matter of such public significance for all the reasons we've already talked about that only the most senior judges in the land can preside over such a matter. Now, the reason I have extreme confidence that the current Supreme Court would back us 100% is because, firstly, they made in February or March the Taggart verdict, as I alluded to before, the fraud unravels all verdict, and they did so knowing that the Court of Appeal had ruled the opposite of that a few years ago, and they'd been using that Court of Appeal verdict to say, in when we brought the arguments, the same arguments that have now succeeded were previously dismissed, and the argument that they used to dismiss our perfectly valid grounds was that even if the bank committed fraud, it's too late now. You can't bring it now. You should have done this long ago, and they would use any excuse under the sun to throw it out. Well, now the Supreme Court have given us the ammunition through the Taggart case when that argument is put forward to say fraud unravels all as per Taggart, which means judgments that rely upon fraudulent evidence are void and illegal and unenforceable, and that goes for land registry registrations, etc. So basically these actions, they will start to proceed soon after the 21st of July, and what I'm asking everybody listening to do is to spread the word about TGBMS. If you don't understand, go to the website. You can also go to my blog, thebenician.net, look in the section marked banking crimes, and you will see the entire story of our case and everything in intricate detail. And you will also see that there have been results of late since the Takhar verdict in the county court that we've never seen before. In other words, Richie, for the first time, everybody who's going in making the right arguments is getting somewhere, provided it's not already too late and a possession order is already in the process of being enforced. Then it's very difficult to stop. But we're also organizing an unlawful eviction task force on Facebook to get numbers and bodies to peacefully resist as many of these unlawful evictions as possible, because it's still happening every day. Yeah. So if everyone listening can help to spread the word far and wide about TGBMS, get to grips yourself with the information. Don't just take mine or anybody else's word for it. All of this, every single word that I've said in the last 55 minutes or whatever, it's all based upon experience, research, and just to let you know that at the end of almost a 10-year battle with Bank of Scotland, Bank of Scotland conceded. They capitulated a 2.5 million claim against my family after already stealing 9 properties, but they couldn't steal my parents' house or my sister's house. And the last remaining void mortgage over my sister's house was cancelled in February. This means that the land registry is no longer ruling. The only defence that the banks had is valid. That means that the bank's arguments that an equitable mortgage still exists when you sign that void deed, even if the void deed turns out to be illegal, that can no longer be relied upon by the banks. And when everybody who is doing this, who is taking these arguments on, is putting this to the legal representatives, many of them are putting the phone down because they just don't know what to say. Everything's falling apart for them, Richie.
This is good news, Michael. It really is, and I'm going to say again, people, watch the Great British Mortgage Swindle. Go to the website, thegreatbritishmortgageswindle.net. You will know somebody who's in mortgage difficulty, who's in so-called arrears, who's in under the gun, under an enormous amount of pressure. Share this information with them. Movements are happening. People are standing up to it, and we're going to watch it, Michael, with obvious great interest, because it affects every one of us. It affects me, of course. Now, we had lots of tweets on this, by the way. I'm sorry I didn't read them, but we've had a lot of tweets on this. Number of people who made the point that the rental sector is just as fraudulent itself for its own reasons, you know, when you're privately renting from a landlord. But of course, it's all tied up in the Great British Mortgage Fraud environment anyway. But thanks for all those tweets that came in. TheGreatBritishMortgageSwindle.net is the website. And you can follow Michael on Twitter. Let me just bring those details up. Michael can be found on Twitter at The Bernician. That's B-E-R-N-I-C-I-A-N, at The Bernician. I follow him, Michael, there. And there are links to his own blog, as he said, TheBernician.net as well. Powerful stuff, Michael. I wish you the very best, mate. You know that. I'll be watching it closely. You're welcome back. When there are updates to be made to our listeners, you can pick up the phone and come back on the programme anytime you want. The film is brilliant. It's factual. There isn't a claim made in it that hasn't been substantiated or backed up by you and your team. I think it's terrific, mate. I really do. So good luck with everything. Good luck with everything. I'll give you the final word, of course, Michael, before we finish today. But I'll be pulling for you. I'm watching it with great interest.
Well, I'd just like to say thank you for inviting me on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure. I hope everyone listening has found it of some assistance in helping them understand exactly what the mortgage fraud is and why it's in everybody's best interest to do something about it. And that means that it's us. We've got to stand up. People are standing up. And the more that stand shoulder to shoulder and say, you know what? We want a better world for our children. We want everybody in this country to go to, and everywhere else, to go to bed not having to worry about being dragged out of their beds, down the stairs, chucked outside into the street and left for dead with their children. We want a world, we want a country where that cannot happen, because just a short time ago, that's what it was like here. So it's not an impossibility. And that's why I ask from the bottom of my heart, everybody, to get behind TGBMS and do whatever you can to help.
Couldn't add anything to that, Michael. Thanks very much. I look forward to speaking to you again real soon. Cheers, mate. Michael O'Bernicia, live on The Richie Allen Show, Monday, July 8th, 2019. There isn't anything more important. You will not hear anything more important than that today, or this week, or any other week, because everybody is under the gun in this country. In my country as well, in Ireland, we've talked about it a lot. The Great British Mortgage Swindle.net is the website. Buy the film, support independent filmmaking and journalism like that, because if you don't, we won't have it for very long. Terrific stuff, and we'll follow the court cases as they develop later on this month and for the rest of the year. That's about it for the programme. Big shout out to Diane Emerson for coming on in the first hour, and you've just been listening to Michael O'Bernicia. There, top stuff. Going to love you and leave you. Back again with you tomorrow morning for the newspaper review show on YouTube. That's youtube.com. And the Richie Allen Radio Show, of course, tomorrow at 5 p.m. UK time. I'll tell you more about that tomorrow. All right?
All right.
Going to leave you with Neil Young. See you tomorrow. Look after yourselves and one another. Share the programme when you see it on social media. All right? Bye now. See you tomorrow. Bye.